Evening, everyone. We are going to take this opportunity tonight to introduce my planned theme for the year when it is my privilege to speak here on a Sunday, and Lord willing, the first one for this year will be this coming Sunday. And so we're going to kind of lay some foundation, some groundwork for this tonight. We're going to call this Leaders Naturally, or Leaders Naturally. You can intonate, punctuate that either way you want. We're still going to arrive at the same objective. So, to start tonight, Genesis 2 and 7. Genesis 2 and 7. Then the Lord God formed the man from the dust of the ground, and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and the man became a living creature. First question for the evening is, who was the man?
Adam.
This is Adam, of course. Have you ever noticed that there is no other man in the Scripture, Old Testament or New, with this particular name? Only this guy. Now, there's a city that is mentioned in the Old Testament that has the same spelling, same name. I guess that means it was the man city, because basically what this name means is the man. That's what it means. The man. He was the first man. He's the man. Adam. A descendant of this man, Esau, was given another name that is similar. It is a derivative of this name, Adam, and it is similar to it, but not the same exact name. Remember what Esau's name was changed to? Edom. Right. Esau means hairy, and Edom means red. And why was he given the name red? Well, we can kind of associate that, maybe, but there was an event with his brother. Remember when he came in from the fields and he was famished? His brother Jacob was cooking something. A lentil soup. Red lentils being used for this. King James calls it porridge or pottage or something, but it's a stew made with red lentils. So the association is made. But then, by extension, The name Adam, then, this idea of putting this all together, means the first man, the man formed from, shall we say, the red earth. And if we say that, then we can say that first man was a red man. Well, he certainly wasn't a white man. But we might say that he was a red man by making these associations. Edom is a derivative form of Adam. It means red, taken from the idea that Adam, the first man, was formed from the red earth. So by expansion then, or extension then, the first man from the red earth. Now, Brother Tom has been taking us through 1 Timothy chapter 2 of late. 1 Timothy chapter 2, verse 3. Verse 13. 1 Timothy chapter 2, verse 13. For Adam was formed first, then Eve. Adam was formed first, then Eve. If I could have a couple of volunteers to read a couple of related scriptures, I have one in Colossians 1:15, and one is in Hebrews 12:23. The second one? Okay, you've got Hebrews, Bill. Hebrews 12:23, First one is Colossians 1:15. Terry, thank you. And we'll get to those in just a minute. Looking at again at 1 Timothy 2:13, for Adam was formed first, then Eve. We're talking about precedence by order of priority. This is a term that we find in Scripture sometimes translated firstborn, or the concept, the idea of first formed or formed first. And this is what's presented in this verse with Adam. He was formed first, then Eve. Adam was made from the earth. Eve was made from the rib of Adam. Adam was formed first. Precedence by order of priority. Could we have Colossians 1:15, please? All right, thank you. And in Colossians 1:15, who is the individual being talked about there? This is Christ. Christ being the image of the invisible God, that is the only member of the Godhead to have ever taken upon themselves flesh and blood and lived in the body of a man on the earth. But as he said when he spoke, when he taught, the words that he said were the words of his Father. They were not his own words. Whatever his Father told him to speak, that is what he spoke. So he was the revelation. He was all of the words of God with flesh and blood, with bones and a frame on it, in a man. But some, actually, Terry, could you also read verse 18 there, if you would please? All right, thank you. And that really ties it all together. There are some who go to Colossians 1:15 and they try to make a doctrine that says that Jesus was a created being. That he is a created being. And instead of being eternal, part of the Godhead, then having taken upon the form of a man and all that, they try to say that there's one organization in particular that makes him out basically to be Michael the Archangel. But that's missing the whole point of the discussion there in Colossians. The whole point is about preeminence. He has been given this position of preeminence. He has bought the church with his own blood. He was faithful to his Father's will, taking upon this body, being the sacrifice, being faithful in every way. And he has been made by God, his Father, as Peter preaches on the day of Pentecost, Lord and Christ. He is the anointed ruler. So in everything, he has the preeminence. As Colossians also bears out, nothing of the material nature of the universe, of the earth, came into existence except by him and through him. So he is first and foremost in everything, in reality. And certainly with regard to the church, he is the head of it. And that is the idea. He has the preeminence of the church. He is the head of the church. And it is his body. It is his bride. And then Hebrews 12:23.
To the general assembly, the church of the firstborn, who are enrolled in heaven, and to God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of righteous men made perfect.
All right, thank you. So the phrase in that verse, the firstborn, who does that refer to? Well, that they would be covered in the word church. Church of the firstborn. Who is the firstborn?
Christ.
This is Christ. And just like we saw it presented there in Colossians, he is that individual. He is the first formed. He is the firstborn. It is the idea of first by order of precedence, by order of priority. All of these use the Greek word or the Greek root protos, which means foremost in time, place, or importance. So, looking at Colossians 1:15, we also looked at verse 18, looking at a companion verse, and there's others we could look at, but we also looked at Hebrews 12:23. Christ has preeminence over all creation, and he has headship over the church. And then looking at 1 Timothy 2:13, man in the creation order is first. And thus, by being first, being formed first, bestowed upon him is the important role of leadership. And that is the context of the passage in 1 Timothy 2, is his leadership, his headship over his wife, over the woman. As Christ is head of the church, he is head of his wife. And other passages, as you know, go along with that. So, first or precedence by order of priority. Sometimes firstborn, sometimes first formed or formed first, depending on your English translation. Any thoughts on that part before we proceed and look at another word here? All right. Could someone read for us Genesis chapter 19? In Genesis chapter 19, we're going to highlight verse 1 and verse 9. Thank you, Kevin. Genesis 19, verse 1 and verse 9.
Now the two angels came to Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. When Lot saw them, he rose up to meet them, and he bowed himself with his face toward the ground.
Okay. Where is Lot sitting when these messengers come? At the gate of the city. Is that significant? What is significant about the fact that Lot is sitting at the gate of the city?
Usually the gathering place for rulers of the city. Meet, greet, and have discussions of the city's needs.
All right, so they were the city fathers, they were the rulers of the city, they were the body of elders for the city. The term that we're looking at now is the term elders. And understanding, with our theme, leaders naturally, when it comes to the concept of elders, this is an ancient concept. Biblically, we can't go back far enough to find when it isn't there, really. Because here we have Lot. Lot is contemporary with Abraham. And by the time you have man in cities, you have this idea. In Job 29, verse 7, when I went out to the gate through the city, when I prepared my seat in the street, Job 29, verse 7, Job 31, verse 21, if I have lifted up my hand against the fatherless, when I saw my help in the gate, or you could have that alternately translated, when I could make a difference at the gate or have an influence at the gate as to regard to the outcome of those fatherless is the idea. Job 31, 21. Now, Job is considered to be contemporary in time with Abraham also. So here we have it. At least as far back as Abraham, we can see this idea being put forward. Now, let's have three... Yes, sorry, Kevin.
Yeah. A really good example of that is in Proverbs 31.
I'm going there. Well, I'll just put these two out. We won't be ready for them yet, but why don't you be ready with that one, if you would. Proverbs 31:31, and then Ruth 4:1, if somebody could be ready with that one. Okay, Terry. And I see your hand, Bill, and I'm going to give out some more scriptures in Exodus, then we'll get to that. We'll look at these three first, talk about them a little bit, and then come to the Ruth 4:1 and the Proverbs 31:31. These three are all found in Exodus. Exodus 3:16. Someone like to read that one? Okay, Bill. Then the next one is 4:29. Amanda, thank you. And then finally 17:5 of Exodus. Okay, Lavinia, thank you. All right, now, I'll pause for a moment because you had a thought there, Bill. I don't want to...
Well, I don't think we read Genesis 19 and 9. None of the ones you wanted to mention.
Did I...
Verse 1 and verse 9.
Ask for 2. You only
had one. Oh, yeah, we didn't read verse 9. I'm sorry.
Sorry, I just want to make sure it wasn't okay. The key to your argument or anything.
No, it supplements what we've already said. So I passed that one by. Sorry about that. Thank you. So, yes, we did... Regarding Lot, we wanted to notice in chapter 19 of Genesis, verse 1 and verse 9. Then we had Job 29:7 and Job 31:21. Now we want to look at 3 here in the book of Exodus, beginning with Exodus 3:16.
Go and gather the elders of Israel together, and say to them, "The Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has appeared to me, saying, I am indeed concerned about you and what has been done to you."
Okay, and 4:29. Thank you. And 17:5. That was yours, Lavinia, right?
The Lord answered Moses, "Go on, all of you, all the people. Take with you some of the elders of Israel and take them on your care of this man, who keeps your sword for now, and go on to pray at home."
All right, thank you. So looking at these 3 sample references in Exodus and considering our word, elders, what do these verses tell us?
They existed.
They existed. They had elders. Israel already had elders when they were in Egypt, and Moses often dealt with the people through them. And at God's direction, he did this. God said, go to the elders and say this or do this. Yes, Bill.
Even while they were under slavery.
Even while they were under slavery.
When most groups wouldn't consider themselves a group.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They did. Yeah. Even while they were slaves. Because the first reference, obviously, is the first time that Moses is told to go to this body of rulers. And that was before the Exodus. Okay. Any other thoughts looking at those? All right. Now, associating where Kevin was commenting earlier, these two, again, are speaking of this concept of elders sitting at the gate. And let's go ahead and read Ruth 4 and 1. Okay, and we remember what's going on here. The good man Boaz is giving opportunity for one who is actually closer in line than he himself for the right to claim Ruth and all of her inheritance, excuse me, and to take on the Levirate responsibility of raising up seed to the deceased, Ruth's former husband who had died. But we have Boaz here among these elders, and at least, at the very least, I mean, I think it's inferred that Boaz was probably among those elders, but at the very least, we have it being a matter of showing us that when an important decision has to be made, this is where they do that, at the city gate with the elders. Now, Proverbs 31:31, Kevin, go ahead and read that one, and then we'll say a little bit more here.
Yeah, this is Proverbs 31:23.
Okay.
Her husband is respected at the city gate where he takes his seat among the elders of the land.
Yes, that one's more clear. Yeah, I had another reason for the other verse.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But no, that's that. I'm glad you mentioned that. That was good. I like the part about let her works bring her praise at the city gates, because it's her husband who is bringing her praise, but it's also those other men, because she has such a good reputation and it is a thing known about her. So I favored the other one, but I'm glad you brought out verse 23 as well. And actually, it's probably talking about Ruth. In the sense that it is widely thought that the telling of this to Solomon And we won't get into all of that. I know it says Lemuel and all of that, but Solomon and Lemuel are like some other names and titles that we'll talk about. There's given names, and then there's names they had because of their office. And Lemuel might have been actually Solomon's mother's pet name for him. But it seems to be that it was a story that was repeated often in the family about the good Ruth, this fine woman, and her reputation lived on through the... I mean, a book was written about her, and we read about her still. She's famous, and she was famous within this household, and the thoughts that are presented there in Proverbs 31 about the worthy woman, Ruth was probably the model that was being looked at for that worthy woman. And then, so we can picture again Boaz and the elders and the gates and all that.
He wasn't an elder as far as age and wealth. I think he says he commends her for not going after the elders.
Mm-hmm.
And partly, he's not among the elders. He makes a statement.
Right, right.
Age-wise, he's also good.
Right. And when we get into talking about the structure for the New Testament church, and we look at the different descriptive terms that are used, The term for elder is a term that implies age and experience. Is what it carries with it. So that's hand in glove with what you were saying there. All right. Any other thoughts?
I've got a reference in that Numbers. Can you answer that?
Sure.
11, chapter 11, verse 16. The Lord said unto Moses, gather unto me 70 men of the elders of Israel, thou knowest to be the elders of the people, officers over them, and bring them into the tabernacle of the congregation, that they may stand there with me, and I will come down and talk with thee there, and I will take of the Spirit which is upon thee, and will put on them, and they shall bear the burden of the people with thee, and thou bear it not thyself alone.
Mm-hmm. And that is a very good reference that was not on my list, but pertains to some others that are. And we're going to talk about those 70, and that they're a significant group of men there. Yeah, and that was Numbers 11?
11:16.
Numbers 11:16. Yeah, that's fits right in there. All right. And we'll touch on some things related to that. Let's go to Exodus chapter 19. And I'm going to throw a little bit of a conundrum at you. And it's not a difficult thing if we just pause and think about it. We're going to talk now about the word priests. Priests is our word. Okay? Exodus 19, verse 6, and Exodus 19, 22. We're going to look at them now, and I want you to be thinking about them. We're going to come back to them. Exodus 19, verse 6. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the people of Israel. It is being expressed by God, His desire to make the nation of Israel a kingdom of priests. All right, then verse 22. Also let the priests who come near to the Lord consecrate themselves, lest the Lord break out against them. Look at these two verses in context, ponder them, and the objective is reconciling them. How do we reconcile Exodus 19, verse 6? Which expresses God's desire to make the entire nation of Israel a kingdom of priests, with verse 22 that says they already had priests. That's the little assignment you can put on the back burner while we look at some things. Now let's go over to the New Testament for a moment. To Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 4. By faith, Abel offered to God a more acceptable sacrifice than Cain, through which he was commended as righteous, God commending him by accepting his gifts, and through his faith, though he died, he still speaks. And of course, the story is found over in the book of Genesis chapter 4 that is being referenced here. Genesis chapter 4. And let's highlight verse 4. Genesis 4, 4. And Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat portions, and the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering he had no regard. Now, by faith, Romans 10, 17 says faith comes by hearing, hearing by the word of God. There's a lot of discussion we could have here, a lot of very valuable teaching, but let's be very precise with our focus right now, looking at Hebrews 11 and 4 and Genesis 4 and 4. What does this tell us about Abel? What does this tell us about Cain? Well, I know there might be a tendency because of the way you go Genesis 1, 2, 3, 4, to not really put together that these are grown men by the time we get to chapter 4. These are not boys. These are not teenagers. These are grown men, heads of households, heads of families. How was it done at this time regarding heads of families? Who acted as the religious functionary? The head of the family, the man who was the head of the family, did that. So Abel was acting as priest. We know that Abel acted by faith. That means that he had been taught. He knew what was right. So did his brother Cain. Cain made a bad decision, continued to make bad decisions regarding that. But Abel acted by faith, doing what was the right thing. And we know that he was acting as a priest because he made sacrifice. The Lord accepted his sacrifice. And the Lord commended, which usually went hand in glove with this. There's covenants that are given at such times. There's promises made by God at such times when he accepts these kinds of sacrifices. But the main point for us to understand is that Abel was a priest. He was acting as this religious functionary in the way of the patriarchs and how this was done. We find Noah doing this, don't we? After the flood in Genesis chapter 8, 20 through 22 especially, we have Noah taking from all of those designated animals and offering burnt offerings to the Lord. And then also, what do we see the Lord doing? We see the Lord giving a pronouncement of blessing upon them and telling them to be fruitful and multiply. It extends right on into the ninth chapter in verses 1 through 17. It's not just Noah, but it also lets us know that his sons are being talked to as well because they have wives and they're going to be starting their own family groups, right? And so to Noah and his sons, God makes this promise. He says, I'm never going to destroy the earth again by a flood. I'm putting my sign of my covenant up in the sky, the rainbow, and all of these things. He's talking to priests. He's talking to the religious functionaries for their families. This is what's going on. We have Melchizedek, who is identified in Genesis 14, 17 through 20. What is he called? The word priest is used in the text. He's priest of the Most High God. He's a priest of Jehovah God. He makes prophecy. He blesses Abraham. He receives tithes of Abraham. Melchizedek is interesting because whereas there were, these little family priests, if you on a smaller scale, but there does seem to be with Melchizedek this picture that there were some maybe higher up priests, if you want to say it that way, or covering more territory or more widely respected, that kind of a thing. Melchizedek is priest of the Most High, and the lesser gives tithes to the greater, and that discussion is all made clear in the book of Hebrews. Obviously, we have Abraham. Look at Genesis 22, and especially verse 5 there of that chapter. And there's others you can look at with regard to Abraham acting as this religious functionary for his clan, his tribe, his people. Inferences, many inferences in Genesis chapter 26 with regard to Isaac, especially with covenant being mentioned there in verse 4, God making mention of covenant promise. This is the kind of words he gives to one of his priests, if you will. In Genesis 28:18, that's where he makes the rock and he pours oil on it and he calls the place Bethel or House of God. And all of those examples are before the Levitical priesthood. Those are all before the Levitical priesthood. Yes, Mike. Yes. Mm-hmm. Daily, doesn't it indicate that he does that? Okay, thank you. The where I get daily in my mind, if I may confess just a little bit here, is I associate that being a father with my prayers. And so I have several children to pray for every day, and I do. So that's, I'm not building an altar and offering a bullock on the altar, but I'm offering up my prayers. So, thank you. That's a good passage. That was in the first part of Job. Again, the chapter is 1 and 5. All right, so, again, before the Levitical priesthood. Now, do we have any other kinds of priests? I mean, these are all associated with Jehovah. But does the Old Testament tell us about any others? It does. There were other priests also. The father-in-law of Joseph, Genesis 41, highlight verse 45 and verse 50. He was an Egyptian priest of the great temple at On there in Egypt. And these priests in these ancient kingdoms were very, very important individuals. They often possessed sufficient power to set up kings, to overturn kings, to overturn one form of worship in favor of another, like what happened in the 18th Egyptian dynasty when the priests made a change there and they helped Tutankhamun to reestablish a polytheistic religion where his father had made previously a monotheistic religion, and the priests helped him overturn that and make a change for that form of worship. In ancient Sumer, the priests had their powerful religious center in and around the famous ziggurat, or zoned tower, at Ur, where Abraham was called out of. The Sumerian priests, they were priest-kings. In their language, patesi is what they were called. The Babylonian kings, from Sargon I to Nabonidus, the last Chaldean king of Babylon, had their priests and their priestesses. And Jethro, father-in-law to Moses, is an interesting case. Earlier I mentioned the distinctions between names and titles. Was Jethro his name? We associate it that way. We use it that way. We think of it that way. But actually, that was his title. If you read in Exodus 2, 16 through 22, and Exodus 3:1, we find out that his name was Reuel. That was his actual name. Jethro was his function, if you will, his title, used that way. Now, looking at Exodus 18, 10 through 12, and this connects with one of the passages that we had earlier that John brought in there about the 70 there. This is where that whole concept starts. And you really need to read that whole chapter, Exodus 18, for context there. We won't take the time to do that. But for our main purpose, looking at verses 10 through 12, it was Jethro, or Reuel, who looked at the situation with Moses, and he said, "This is not good." I've been thinking about this a lot since, I have done in the past, but even more recently as I've been studying about this for this class. He makes this suggestion to Moses. He says, "This is not good. It's not good for you. It's not good for the people. You're going to wear them out. You're going to wear yourself out." And that's how it is. When you have one man up on a pedestal, he gets rather dizzy. And it's not good for anybody when he's put up there. And Jethro could see this, and he makes this suggestion that you look out, and there's qualifications that are given, and you find men of this caliber, and you delegate, and you appoint them over these things. And there's everyday matters that they can handle. If it's something of great seriousness, then they can bring it before you. But otherwise, this is going to fall apart. This is not going to work. And the thing is, the Lord blesses this. The Lord blesses this. And I'm inclined to think, the more I think about it, that the Lord was inspiring this, directing this. Because from here on out, it's used by Him very definitely, this whole idea. This is where the whole concept of the judges begins. And these 70, this number 70 that's very significant and remains significant all the way down to, how many were on the Sanhedrin Council? 70. It goes all the way down to there. And I think that's very interesting.
It comes on down to the plurality of elders.
And it does. It does. The concept is definitely there. And we're going to make the tie-in, because we were talking elders, and that's when you came up with that verse. And then we went to priests. And now we got to marry these two and solve our conundrum here. Throughout the Old Testament, when we find this word priest, it is the word Kohen. Now, most of us in this room know Thomas Kuhn. I can't run by this name without mentioning it, because that's where his name comes from. His surname comes from this word. Anyone that has a name like Keen or Cuny or Kuhn or Cohen or those kinds of names, they all come from this name, Kohen in the Hebrew. Now, the word is of uncertain origin, but without a doubt, it predates its use in the Scripture when it is being used in regard to the Levitical priesthood. It's there before the Levitical priesthood is there. And we're going to look at the Levitical priesthood a little more. So, again, leaders, naturally, there's going to be leaders. God sees to that. It's going to be the case. Our challenge is to be the leaders prescribed by God and not just what we make up ourselves. But like nature abhors a vacuum, it's going to happen. There's going to be leaders. And that's a fact. Now, in ancient times, this word Kohen meant seer, the idea of a seer. The general idea was one that has to do with divine things. The derivation and biblical usage of these words really doesn't give us a lot of light. We see from the Bible study that we're talking about a religious functionary, whether pagan, Genesis 41, 45, Acts 14, 13, or biblical, Matthew 8, 4, 1 Peter 2, 5, and 9. And, of course, in the New Testament, it's the Greek word hieros, and it means the same thing. It conveys the same general meaning as the word Kohen in the Hebrew. But, bring it down to English, and it gets a little more interesting. Where do we get our English word priest? We don't call them Kohen. We don't call them hieros, or some derivative of those words. We say priest. Where does that come from? It comes from a Greek word. Now, if we're talking about leadership, and in particular we're talking about the government and structure of the church, what's a Greek word that you might be able to think of? It has to do with elders. Presbyteros. Our English word priest comes from the Greek word presbyteros, which is used for elders of the church in the New Testament Greek. Very interesting. All right. I'm going to run out of time here. We do need to talk about resolving our little conundrum here. But here's some numbers I'll throw out. We'll go back before our number 70. This comes before that number in the chronology. The number is 603,550. What's significant about that number from the Old Testament? 603,550. Okay, what about them? All of them, or?
Men
who are 20 years of age or older. Numbers chapter 1, verses 1 through 5, and verse 40. Come to the total there, 603,550. Okay, I lied, John. When you were reading that earlier, I knew I'd looked at it, but I did have it on my list. Okay, numbers. No, it should have been, and it is. Numbers chapter 10, verses 11 and 12, and Numbers 11, 16. That's the one that John read earlier. That's where we get the number 70. All right. Now, another number. Because here, it's diminishing. We have this big number, 603,550. And qualifications are given with that and everything. And then we have Jethro's thing. He gives qualifications. They find 70 that fit the bill. They come up with the number 70. Out of that 70, 12. What am I talking about if I'm looking at numbers 13, 1 and 2? Head of each tribe, when it came time to spy out the land of Canaan, that was the number, one from each tribe. The head of each tribe. All right, now a very much smaller number. We started out with 603,550. Now we're down to 2. What number am I talking about? Who am I talking about? Joshua and Caleb. The only spies of the 12 who were faithful, who came back with the good report, which lets us know that wholehearted devotion to God is indeed a very rare thing. But because there were two only, did that automatically disqualify the other 10 from being heads, leaders? No. Now, those other 10 didn't get to go into the promised land because of their unfaithfulness, but they were not stripped of their position by God, were they? Nor did they eliminate the 70, because we've established how the 70 comes right on down to the Sanhedrin Council, and that concept was well in place all the way down. Yes, Kylie.
Jesus sent out 70 also, although some manuscripts say
72. Yeah. When he sent out some of his disciples. Yeah. Some other scriptures you can look at with what we're talking about, in particular with the two, of course, is Numbers 14:38, Numbers 26:25, Numbers 32:12. And I bring this part up because I'm very much aware that there are congregations, and I'm not saying that's the case here, but it needs to be mentioned, but there are congregations that fail to ever establish scriptural leadership in their congregation because they hide behind this idea that, well, they've got, they make this standard up here in such a way that, well, we know that no one will ever be able to achieve that. And so we're not going to ever have any elders. We had two men who came through out of the thousands, but the others were still leaders. God didn't say, "You're out now." Yes, Michael. Okay. Thank you for that clarification. They certainly did not, they died in the wilderness. They did not get to enter into the promised land. But, all right. I was getting maybe slightly carried away there with that, with the 10. But thinking still of the 70, they still had that. That was well established. They didn't eliminate that. They didn't say, all right, since we're just going to leave it to these two because the rest of you are no good. No, it wasn't done like that. Yes. Yes. And it does illustrate how God had to take care of the situation right away because, yeah, okay, yeah. Well, basically, they were influenced by those other 10 because none of them got to go. None of them got to go in. Yeah. All right, we need to wrap this up. They've already figured out that it's time to come out here. I need to ring the bell for the downstairsers. So, what about reconciling Exodus 19 and 6 and Exodus 19, 22? Yes, Terry.
22:22.
Wait a minute. Are you sure about that?
No.
We don't have them yet. Well, just look at verse 22. I mean, who are they? Who are they? Kevin.
God wants all the people to be His people, to be His servants, and priests in that respect. But I think that there are, well, this, especially on this side, this group of people that's going to be leaders. Uh-huh. I think that's probably what we're saying.
Okay. I'm going to open this up. What I'm going to show everybody here is homework for Sunday night or Sunday afternoon. And I'll say a little bit about it. But I want to dig carefully, and I'm glad that we had a clarification because I was going astray on a point there a moment ago because we don't want to do that going astray. 19:22 of Exodus is clearly before we have a high priest, before we have a Levitical priesthood. That has not been designated yet. The offer in Exodus 19 and 6, if embraced, would have made every Israelite a priest after they heard and accepted God's covenant. And that's what was going on there. God was thundering from the mountain. And that's when they said, "No, we can't take that. Moses is our man." They rejected direct interaction with God when they heard the voice from the mountain, and they requested intercession. In reality, that's what they requested, which means a period between two sessions or terms. Exodus 20, 18 through 21, 1 Samuel 8, 7 and 8. And because of their request, not only was Moses' role changed, but the Aaronic priesthood, and here, Terry, here's where it comes, the Aaronic priesthood came about because of their request. Because of their request that the Aaronic priesthood came about. And the promise, the offer of God for a kingdom of priests had to wait. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 9. But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for His own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of Him who called you out of darkness into His marvelous light. So what God wanted had to wait until the new covenant. Revelation speaks of this also, putting it in the past tense, referring to God's people as a kingdom of priests, having been made a kingdom of priests. So, however, clearly from Exodus 19:22, there were already priests among the children of Israel, which preceded the covenant. Jethro had just recently been among them, Exodus 18:1, as we talked about. But it's no difficult stretch to suppose that if Jethro was a priest of Midian and Melchizedek had been a priest of God Most High and the Egyptians had priests, Genesis 41:50, that the Israelites would have had priests among them too. Not the ones that God had ordained, not the ones that God had given direction for, but they had them. And that's really the purpose of our whole exercise this evening. Because our objective is to understand that there are going to be leaders. Naturally, there will be leaders. Leaders will assert themselves. Just look at the husband and wife relationship. Just look at what we've been talking about with regard to 1 Timothy chapter 2 and touching on some of the ideas about the role of women. Men, we've been given the leadership role. But what if I don't do what I'm supposed to do? Is somebody else going to see that it gets done? Yes. It will get done. Is that necessarily a God-honoring process by which it gets done? No. But it will get done. Nature abhors a vacuum. So the whole point of our discussion tonight is to appreciate and to understand that there are going to be leaders. We can't deny the fact that there are going to be leaders. So our objective is to be the leaders that God wants us to be. That's the point of this whole exercise. All right. Very quickly, we're already over time, but up here on the board, this is the homework for the afternoon session Sunday. There's basically four ways that a congregation can be organized. Scripturally organized, scripturally unorganized, unscripturally organized, or unscripturally unorganized. Write those down and be thinking about them and be thinking about what those are saying. Give me some thoughts, examples, descriptions, definitive terms of those four categories. That'll be for our discussion Sunday afternoon. Lord willing, get to that part for Sunday afternoon. I'll leave it there with you for tonight, and we are going to extend the invitation. I was going to read John chapter 10, but we're short on time. Add that to your homework. Think about that chapter about the Good Shepherd this week. And we'll extend the invitation at this time as we stand and sing.
I just want to say one more quick word, if I may. You may have seen that Terry made the convenient move there so I could bring the point down firmly home. I wasn't intending to be harsh or sound like I was picking on you, Terry. It's to challenge all of us in our thinking. And I know exactly when and where I did the very same thing. Well, it must have been what you said. And it wasn't until somebody And that's sometimes what we need, is a little bit of that. I do it out of love and no other motivation. I seem